Hello, I'm Kathleen Downey. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of August. A couple of announcements before we begin all things political. One is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, do join us for special election night coverage on the Ideas Network. WPR's state government reporter Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager will be talking with analysts and reporters around the state about the results of tomorrow's recall election. It's a constant round, isn't it? Tomorrow night, beginning at 8 o'clock, of course, the series of recall elections will conclude tomorrow with two state Senate districts where Democrats are being forced to defend their seats. We'll talk about that among the many topics we will be discussing with Craig Gilbert, who's joining us momentarily and is our All Things Political guest, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I do want to thank everybody who came to our beautiful reunion party of the Washington, D.C. Group in Toma, Wisconsin on Saturday. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Katie Madsen for taking the trip to Carol's house in Toma. It just couldn't be beat, the view out of her backyard. Absolutely wonderful, and everybody brought fabulous food, and we're talking Toronto or Boston. What do you think? Eh? Let us know. It was a great gathering. You guys are friendly and smart, and it was great. We had a good time. All right. Enough announcements. We go to all things political. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you can do that, talk@WPR.org. We'll talk national news as well, because the Republicans have been busy over the weekend with Rick Perry entering the race, Tim Pawlenty leaving. I got that one wrong. I thought last year he would be their nominee in 2012, but I was wrong. Michelle Bachmann winning the Iowa straw poll. How meaningful is that? We will look at all of that, but we'll start with Wisconsin. Craig wrote an interesting front page story yesterday about what the recall elections mean, and we'll start with this one sentence. If the entire state had been voting Tuesday, the GOP vote would have been around 49%. So basically, we were looking at a 50-50 election, a 50-50 state. What does that mean? We'll welcome phone calls, and we'll welcome Craig right now to the air. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Good. So it keeps on rolling. More tomorrow. 50-50 Wisconsin. We have a completely split state.
Yeah, I think so. And it's not shocking given our recent history. It's just that we had a couple of elections dominated by one party or the other in 2008 and 2010. And it doesn't feel like it's going to be that kind of a year next year. It certainly hasn't been that kind of a year this year. I mean, the two big elections we've had have both been, real close calls. The Supreme Court race was decided by 7,000 votes. And the recall elections, you know, you do have to account for the fact that the people voting in these districts have a Republican makeup, not dramatic, but it's funny. It just, it's about, in the aggregate, these districts are about 3 points more Republican than the state as a whole based on recent election history. And if you do the math, it's not a perfect formula, but if you do the math, and adjust for it, it looks like statewide that would translate to about a 50-50 outcome. So I just think that neither party can really claim to have a huge advantage with the electorate going into next year.
Do you think the Democrats, as some have suggested, had the winds knocked out of their sails and the recall election of the governor will not happen now?
Well, two different questions. I mean, I think there'll probably be an effort to recall the governor, but whether it's successful or not is another question. I do think it was a disappointment for Democrats. I think the Democrats were hoping that, given Scott Walker's polling numbers and given how charged up their side was about and how motivated their side was by his agenda to roll back his agenda, I think they were hoping for more of a unambiguous kind of outcome in these recall elections. I think they were hoping that a backlash against Walker would really fuel a political shift in the state. And instead, I think clearly there's been some erosion for Republicans since 2010, which was a high water mark for them. And Scott Walker's numbers are not very particularly good in all the polls we've seen. But it hasn't produced this sort of wave, counter wave for the Democrats. It's really put us back, into this sort of environment where Democrats and Republicans have to sort of duke it out for every little victory. And I think in that sense, I think Democrats were hoping for something different.
This is the part I don't understand. Given the governor's polling numbers, which are not very strong, why does the election turn out 50-50?
Well, I think, you could a number of reasons. I think these aren't perfect referendums on the governor, just like the Supreme Court race wasn't a perfect referendum on the governor. When you're doing a recall, you're asking people to throw someone out of office that they've recently elected or already elected. And so it's not quite the same thing as having Scott Walker on the ballot. And there's a lot of individual circumstances that go into these races. And I do think that if Scott Walker were on the ballot right now, he'd be in for a tough race, but you can't assume that he'd lose. I mean, we are a very divided state.
Mm-hmm. What did you think? You mentioned two of the candidates whose individual baggage played a role in Hopper's loss in the 18th district and in Fred Clark's loss in the 14th district. Let's look ahead to Democratic candidates. Some are saying that there's just not a strong field out there to run for cold seat or to run in a gubernatorial race. Are there strong candidates? Are there people being groomed? Are there people we know about who are interested?
Well, it's a fair question. I mean, and it's not a question I think we can answer for sure at this point because, A, there are candidates that we know a lot about and potential candidates that we don't know so much about. But even the candidates we know a lot about aren't necessarily people that have run statewide before. You don't know how they're going to perform. You don't know what the political environment is going to be. I do think it's a fair question because, you know, for Democrats, if you just sort of imagine what's the scenario next year, and let's say there is an effort to recall Walker and they're going to need a statewide candidate for that, and let's say, and then you've got the run for Herb Kohl's U.S. Senate seat, and they're going to need a statewide candidate for that. So where are these candidates going to come from? And it's a fair question. We know that, for example, Tammy Baldwin is likely to run for the U.S. Senate. There's a lot of serious conversation on the Democratic side about how electable she is. She's certainly one of the most liberal members of the U.S. House, and she comes out of Madison, which is, the tradition. Russ Feingold got elected out of Madison, but when you're a Democrat running out of Madison, Republicans run against you as a Madison liberal. So on the other hand, she's probably would have the inside track for the nomination. So again, it's a fair question. We don't know the answer to it.
Mm-hmm. More recall elections tomorrow. You write in yesterday's piece, the Republicans lost two with a shot to gain at least one back in the final round of recall elections. Which one are you talking about?
Well, Jim Holprin, his district is pretty Republican. It's basically as Republican as five of the six districts, roughly, that were involved in last week's recall election. He's represented it, for a long time. This is, oddly enough, his second recall, which is kind of a unique thing to have on your resume. Democrats I've talked to say they feel pretty good about this race. It's a different race than it would have been, or a different final week than it would have been had the Democrats picked up another seat last week, because then this race would have been the determiner of control of the state Senate, and you would have seen this remarkable explosion of last-minute spending in a largely rural district in the far north of Wisconsin, which would have been a sight to behold. So, it's the wild card here is, given what happened on Tuesday, how does that affect motivation on both sides? And not to mention spending and organizational activity. I mean, there's going to be a lot of work put into that race because it is significant whether Republicans have a 17-16 advantage or an 18-15 advantage. We know that Dale Schultz, for example, voted against, a Republican from southwestern Wisconsin, voted against the collective bargaining changes, and so he could be a swing vote under a 17-16 scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So it does matter.
I was listening to another radio station this morning, and they were talking about some of the ads being run in that and couldn't understand why racial unrest in Milwaukee was the focus of some of the ads by the Republican challenger when it was in a Northwoods district, hardly a real diverse part of the state.
Yeah, I think you see kind of everything but the kitchen sink in some of these races. And again, this is one of the reasons why you have to be cautious about interpreting outcomes when, you know, judging from the way the campaigns are waged. You've got, I mentioned in the column, you've got these very individual factors of the personal strengths and flaws of the candidates. So we're reading into, for example, the outcome of these races, things that in part were shaped by just random personal factors. And you look at some of the ads that were run in some of the races last week. You know, Fred Clark had the incident where he was caught on camera in his car hitting a bicyclist. I mean, that's just one of a list of things on both sides that were fodder for advertising. And some of these things that are fodder for advertising have no real political content. They're entirely personal. Some of them have political content, but they're not really necessarily on the subject that we would expect the campaign to be waged on, which is either the budget or collective bargaining or maybe even some of the bigger, broader issues that separate the parties in Washington. So again, I mean, it is important to pay attention to what the candidates, you know, what's not just the candidates, but these outside groups are doing with their advertising that all have different agendas, and all of these things end up being factors in the result.
I can't tell you, and I'm sure you've heard this as well, Craig, how many people have over the weekend and since the recall said, I can't believe how much money was spent on this. We could have used it for so many other purposes.
Yeah, and that's a natural reaction, and we've heard that before. On the other hand, you know, when the stakes are high, you're going to see that. I mean, that's just a reflection of the fact that there was a lot at stake for both parties. It's a reflection of the fact that our system permits it. And that's, you know, there's a legitimate argument to be made that people should have the right to influence these elections. Obviously, there's big debates over what the exact rules should be. But that's our process. And, you know, it's understandable that people are sometimes disgusted by it and appalled by it. You know, it's what are you going to do? I mean, are you going to tell people they can't run ads in these races? And the other interesting thing about that issue is that, you know, every time we see this sort of kind of explosion of advertising and negative advertising, people always wonder, is it turning people off? Is it going to suppress the vote? Is it people so disgusted they're not going to participate? But we saw on Tuesday that participation was very strong, and it turns out that when the stakes are big and when there's passions on both sides and when elections are competitive and when a lot of effort is being put into it by both sides to turn out voters and influence the debate, then that generates high turnout.
Yeah. I just think a lot of people have to be like me, and you see these so often that you say, all right, it's time to go to the bathroom. I've seen this before and before and before and before and before.
Oh yeah, and also, you know, I think people who study these things, who study effects, campaign effects, media effects, advertising effects, will tell you that they're often very, very marginal. And some of the spending is incredibly inefficient. I mean, some of it gets you the returns on it are so marginal to be almost imperceptible. But it's not always the case, and I think. As we saw in some of these races, I mean, you could argue in the race we talked about before between Luther Olson and Fred Clark, which was the race Democrats really needed to win to get the gain of three that they were looking for, that you know, that the ads that were run against Fred Clark had an influence on that race, and that was money, quote, well spent by opponents of Fred Clark and supporters of Luther Olson. If you it's sort of a rule of politics is that, you know, one way to win election is to try to, if you're on the incumbent side and the incumbent's vulnerable, is to disqualify the challenger. And we see that all the time in politics on both sides.
One more for me, then we'll pause and start taking phone calls. Iowa straw poll. I was way off the mark here. If you had asked me last year, and I think I said this, who the Republican rising star was, I would have said Tim Pawlenty, and he's out of the race.
Yeah, and I think that's a classic case of somebody that does, you know, have some strengths on paper, and maybe some assets that would have come into play in a general election campaign. But in a multi-candidate nominating process, you have to have a constituency, you have to have a niche, you have to have an identity, and you have to be able to generate some passion and intensity, because these early tests, like the not just the Iowa caucuses, but the Iowa straw poll, are really tests of intensity, because you're asking people, the people that participate are people that are willing to go to great lengths, take time out of their day, take a bus to Ames, Iowa, or spend half an evening on a freezing night in Des Moines for the caucuses. That requires passion. And so Tim Pawlenty, you know, again, a classic case of somebody that didn't inspire that passion. He didn't really have a strong niche in the race. And you add in the fact that this is the climate within the Republican Party right now. There's clearly a demand for an appetite and a constituency for a very strong conservative mobilizer, and Tim Pawlenty wasn't that.
But don't the Republicans realize, and maybe I'm wrong with this, that it would be extremely difficult for a very, very conservative candidate to win the presidency?
Well, and I think that's the argument we're going to hear when it's Mitt Romney against
Right.
Rick Perry, or Mitt
Yep.
Romney against Michelle Bachmann. And that's an open question. I think it's possible that some Republican voters will in their own minds cast a practical or pragmatic vote in some of these primaries, and their logic may be, you know, we that they come to the judgment that Mitt Romney's more electable against President Obama. Also, it's not just going to be Republican voters that determine this. It's also going to be in some of these states, independent voters. We saw that John McCain could have never won the Republican nomination last time around if it hadn't been for the non-Republican voters voting in Republican primaries and caucuses. So that's kind of the Romney case, and it'll be a great test of that kind of practical electability argument pitted against whoever emerges from the duo of Bachmann and Perry at this point, the candidate that sort of more closely captures the heart and soul of the Tea Party and the conservative heart of the Republican Party.
Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is our guest this hour for All Things Political. We'd like to focus a bit of attention on the last of the 9 Wisconsin Senate recall elections that will be held tomorrow. Jim Holprin and Bob Wirch trying to hold on to their seats here in Wisconsin. And Craig has written extensively and pretty spot on about what the elections have meant to the state of Wisconsin, where we stand politically. There's, of course, national news going on as well, but I'm interested in your thoughts. Let's dissect what happened last week and where we are as a state right now. Do you think that any kind of recall effort against the governor will gain momentum here, considering what many view as a Democratic loss last Tuesday? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number 2 of our program this Monday, we will look at the lost legacy of Herbert Hoover. Craig Gilbert, our guest now. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yes. I don't know if the guest has read last week's column in Time magazine by Fareed Zakaria, but one of the things he was talking about is the way that our redistricting is set up is that it tends to set up safe districts for whichever party is in power. And it creates a situation where people run to the base. They have incentive to run to the base, not to the middle, because they'll be challenged by a primary candidate. So they generally, what we've got now, thanks to Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, there's no left-wing equivalent to those people. We've got extreme right-wing candidates running in the Republican Party. We have basically extreme right. I mean, when I was a child, some of the views I hear spouted by Michelle Bachmann were considered Looney Tunes by my parents, who were dyed-in-the-wool Republicans at the time. But anyway, and the left wing has taken over most of the Democratic Party. And there's, in other words, the most conservative members of the Democratic Party are more liberal than the most liberal members of the Republican Party. So there's no middle ground anymore.
Craig.
Well, absolutely. We're seeing, we've seen this partisan polarization occur both among voters and among elected officials, where both parties, used to have more diversity ideologically internally, and now we've got, everybody to the left of center in one party and everybody to the right of center in another party, no overlap. Political scientists have charted this in the voting behavior of members of Congress, and it's just flat out stark in the trend line. And political scientists debate how much of a factor redistricting is in this phenomenon, but it is the case that parties in power, try to draw districts that are safe for their party, and the one byproduct of doing that is to draw districts that are safe for the other party, because if you're a Republican and you want to draw an advantageous plan for Republicans, one way to do that is to pack as many Democratic voters as possible into fewer Democratic districts, and so that the Democratic vote is distributed inefficiently, and that creates one-sided Democratic districts. So the classic case of this in the current redistricting plan in the state Senate that the Republicans just adopted is these two seats, one in Racine and one in Kenosha, state Senate seats that are both, reasonably competitive right now, because in each case they have sort of an urban component on the lake, and in one case the city of Racine, in one case the city of Kenosha, and they stretch west into the more Republican suburbs and exurbs and rural areas. And the new plan, which is now law, basically takes the urban districts along the lake and creates one Democratic district out of those, and creates the more Republican suburban areas to the west, and creates a Republican, uncompetitive Republican district out of those. And so the overall effect of that plan is both to give the Republicans some structural advantage in terms of their ability to defend their majorities in the legislature, but also overall to reduce the number of competitive districts.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. Just as a quick aside, I'll say that winning two seats against great monetary expenditures by the Republicans in basic Republican districts, I think, was pretty good for the Democrats. They were also close in two other seats. Regarding the national scene and the primaries, the election in Iowa, if you settle for less, you get less. And when it comes time for the Wisconsin primary, if Obama has no liberal opponent in the Democratic primary, I'm going to cross over and vote for Ron Paul. And I just point out to people that Ron Paul came very close. I don't agree with him on domestic issues, but in terms of opposing the wars, I think he's right on target. And he came very close. He only was separated by 112 votes. There were about more than 200 votes that were unaccounted for, that weren't, quotes, couldn't be tallied. And there was some question about the electronic tally of the votes. And as the major media, of course, are doing the best they can to stifle him and not give him exposure. But if you watch C-SPAN, how he handled himself when questioned in the debate, he ate the Republicans' lunch, the basic other Republicans. He ate them up. He handled himself very well. And I just encourage people to, in future Republican debates, to watch Paul on C-SPAN, because he tears them up on a lot of things. And remember that the people that go to these debates are political junkies in the first place, and so they're interested in politics, and they're getting exposed to stuff that normally they don't hear. So to the Republican Party, Paul is a real threat.
Craig.
Well, I think it is the case that Paul doesn't get a lot of, cred in the national media. I mean, people are fascinated by him on one level because he has a very pronounced worldview, libertarian worldview, that puts him at odds with other Republicans on a whole number of issues. On the other hand, I think there's an assumption in the political media
that he's ultimately not a viable candidate within the Republican Party. Now he'll get his shot, and you know the way the process works is you have your chance on the ground in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. If you have a strong following and if you have a distinct constituency, to try to generate support and try to build a candidacy. So he'll have his shot, and we'll see what happens. I mean, he is an interesting guy, and it's an interesting debate, and it's interesting having him in the field because of the conversation it creates with among Republicans. And there's probably some issues you could argue where he's already had an influence on the Republican Party, or at least he's been a little bit ahead of the curve within the Republican Party. Certainly on foreign policy, the drift within the Republican Party post-Bush seems to be a little bit more non-interventionist, which is kind of the direction Ron Paul has been pushing for.
Thanks, Bill, or Jim, rather. We go to Todd on the road. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. I'm wondering, your guest mentioned that Tammy is coming from a Madison and liberal bias. I'm wondering what his thoughts are on her openly lesbian status and whether Wisconsin is ready to elect statewide and open lesbian candidate?
You know, I don't know. I think I don't know the answer to that question. I don't assume that she's not electable for that reason. You know, it's kind of a moving target because attitudes are shifting, and it's very generational in some respects, and and so I'm not sure that would be particularly the obstacle for her. I do think that, again, you know, we could end up, you know, it's one scenario in that race would be to have a candidate just as conservative on the Republican side as she is liberal on the Democratic side. And then it would be an interesting question over in terms of who wins the battle for the middle under those circumstances. But in terms of the caller's question, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not sure it's necessarily a problem for her.
Let's talk about getting the middle. The Times had an interesting piece yesterday on the White House figuring out where to go next concerning the economy, and it seems to me as though the president is really quite vulnerable on this issue. He has been urged to do something bold, to look seriously at more stimulus spending, and for heaven's sake, to come up with some kind of jobs program because so many people are hurting. This article indicated that the president's going to stay kind of a middle course here in an attempt to woo independent voters and will ignore his base on these issues, and there are questions about whether or not a middle course will do anything for the economy. What do you think about it?
Well, he's got a huge political challenge when it comes to the economy. He's been actually until now, or until very recently, was kind of overperforming. And even though his polling numbers weren't great, when you consider the state of the economy and people's pessimism about the direction of the economy, he was actually doing better or not doing as badly in the polling as you might have expected, and as survey research experts would have expected him to be doing, given the kind of traditional correlation between the economy and attitudes toward the incumbent. So, for some reason, he was overperforming a little bit. People were giving him a little bit of a bonus, either because they didn't think this stuff was his fault or because they thought that he was doing okay. Now, the question is whether that's disappeared in recent weeks. He's taken some real blows over the way the debt ceiling debate unfolded, the downgrade, the credit downgrade, the volatility of the stock market. And so now he's kind of in this unenviable position for politicians where the fire is kind of coming from all sides, where, you know, the Republicans have this very focused and sustained critique, but now he's getting it on leadership from the political class, and he's getting it on from the left on his agenda, and that's a very difficult box to be in.
We go to Glenn in Stevens Point. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to mention, talking specifically about the recall of Governor Walker, I would be very, very surprised if it did not occur, because if you look at the mandate of the elections and you look at the makeup, especially if somebody would take a look at those districts that went Republican, the local Republican, for example, Luther Olson, so many of those districts are just absolutely die-hard Republican. Or to expect some of these victories, I think it was wishful thinking, but you have to understand, you can mass the votes in a state. It doesn't matter if Madison, if Milwaukee, or, for example, our Portage County, which has a large concentration, it takes one out of every two people who voted Democratic to sign a signature, and with databases of upwards of 200,000 people who've already signed on, I think mobilization of 540,000 votes is a foregone conclusion, especially if you say, well, let's work it out so it's going to be a referendum on Governor Walker and coincided with the 2012 election. So I think when you look at it that way, this, I guess the side you have, the Senate seats were more hopeful than anything, but I think it's an inevitability because of the way that everything occurred. Every time Governor Walker said, let's be bipartisan, let's work together, is a slap in the face to those saying, are you kidding me? You're walking away from every dirty trick, or at least politically, you can say, depending upon your views, that has taken place, and you're saying, just forget about it, let's move on.
Well, actually, the caller's right about the dynamics of gathering the signatures. Because it's statewide, and you look at, you know, just imagine how many signatures you can get out of Dane County and Milwaukee County and some other Democratic counties. I don't think that's the barrier. I don't think the signatures are the barrier. The question is, you know, the question obviously is the sort of prospects for success. What's the timing? The Democrats have been headed toward a November general election ballot. What does that do to what's the impact on President Obama? What's the impact on these other races? Is it, you know, does it generate more Democratic turnout, or does it also boost Republican turnout? Who's the candidate? You know, what about the finances and what about the impact there on other races? I mean, it's a very complicated political calculus. So I do think they can get the signatures, and I do think that there will be an appetite within the Democratic Party for doing this. And whether the leadership wants to do it or not, they have to decide whether they want to accommodate that appetite or not. And also, you know, there's also the arguments, sort of very tactical, practical arguments for doing something like this. There are probably arguments for doing it and for not doing it, but among the arguments for doing it are, you know, just the organizational one, the mobilization factor, building that kind of campaign. So so it's an interesting call for Democratic strategists as to exactly how they want to do this. I think it's complicated, and I think it was complicated a little bit by the recalls, because you would have had more energy and more enthusiasm psychologically if you'd picked up an extra Senate seat.
I think it was a given, considering what happened in Madison and all over the state with demonstrations, that the Democrats were motivated. I think one of the perhaps more surprising things, because there was so much attention on the Democratic side, that Republicans voted in large numbers last week.
Yeah, and I agree. That was a little bit more of an unknown in this election, and that might have been also where timing came into play. I mean, remember, the Republicans ran these fake Democrats in an effort to push the general elections back by a month. We don't know whether, had the elections been a month earlier, whether they would have turned out any differently. But the effect of doing that was to give these incumbents more time to campaign. It was to extend the campaign. And it was also had the unanticipated effect of having all these national events, dramatic national events and grim economic news kind of rain down in mid the last week or two of the recall campaigns. Whether that had any effect or not, who knows? But you know, it was an interesting scenario, and it did happen that the turnout war was more of a standoff than one might have thought. I mean, usually the anti side is more motivated. But Republicans did turn out their vote, and this is a state where the Republican base is a very engaged part,
yes,
of the electorate, and it's going to be in all these races. And part of that, one reason for that in this context, is that Scott Walker, as much as he's hated by Democrats and Democratic voters, draws a lot of support and a lot of enthusiasm for Republican voters for exactly the same reason.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Glenn, so much for your call. We'll take more calls momentarily. It's All Things Political. You always hear Mondays at 9. Craig Gilbert is our guest, looking at what's going on in Wisconsin. More recalls tomorrow. He's Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he also has an eye on what's going on nationally. 800-486-8655 is the number. One line is open right now. If you can't get through, you can always shoot us an email, too. And that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. We will have election coverage. I don't know if you heard last week, but our coverage was really excellent. And I'm sure it will be tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, special election night coverage with state government reporter Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager. They'll have lots of analysts and reporters around the state to analyze and to tell you the numbers as they're coming in tomorrow for the recall elections. That's tomorrow night at 8 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, we will speak with two writers for The Atlantic Monthly. They have an interesting article this month on Herbert Hoover and his humanitarian efforts. So that's coming up, hour number two. Returning to phone calls for Craig Gilbert, Matt in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the national Republican races. I've worked in past years at the Iowa Straw Poll. And I am very familiar with the fact that it is kind of an evangelical Christian event. The churches in Iowa kind of put that thing together. And you know, the fact that Michelle Bachmann did well is not surprising at all. I think Ron Paul came in within less than 1% of being first in that race. And the fact that he got almost no coverage by the media, I mean, everything I saw in the run-up to this race talked about everybody in the race but Ron Paul. I don't know why the media don't cover him. And I know that he has a very strong organization this time in New Hampshire, much stronger in the past, so I think he's going to be able to get some traction there, too. I saw one other strange thing. Candy Crowley of CNN was talking about the straw poll, and she talked about Rick Perry's entry into the race and called him a darling of the Tea Party. That baffles me. He had a very strong contender in his gubernatorial race that was a Tea Party candidate named Deborah Medina, and they think he's a neoconservative, not a friend of the Tea Party. So that was pretty weird.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Craig?
Well, it will be interesting in the case of Governor Perry to see how that develops, because there are some issues where he may or may not be totally in sync with the conservative base and the party. I mean, one issue that I'm aware of is immigration, where he's, like President Bush, is much more supportive of kind of more liberalized immigration rules, has been critical of the fence, and has also supported some policies in Texas that are probably a little out of step with a fairly large constituency within the Republican Party on immigration that's more restrictionist than he is. So that's one. I don't know enough about him and his record to kind of answer that question exhaustively, but I think it's who's the Tea Party candidate is an open question. You know, it probably depends in part on how you define the Tea Party. But I think one of the interesting things about this race, along with the dynamic we discussed earlier about kind of Romney and the electability argument against a more ideological and candidate, is going to be the battle between what looks like a battle right now between Bachmann and Perry over the grassroots conservatives. Now Ron Paul could also play a role in that. I mean, Ron Paul, again, as we discussed earlier, I think doesn't get the publicity because I just think that there's sort of a working assumption among the national political media that he doesn't have a chance to win the nomination.
Don't you think it's kind of a tough order to run for president when you've publicly talked about seceding from the union?
Well, that'll be part of the discussion about
I would
Rick
think.
Perry. I mean, along with, we haven't discussed, but it's sort of obvious is the implications of running as a Republican governor from Texas for president. 8 years after the Bush presidency, which ended on a pretty unpopular note, and that's clearly would be an issue or a concern, I think, for Republican insiders, would be how that would cut in a general election.
Hugh in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. By the way, I will not vote for an amnesty-type Republican for president. So I have no intention of voting for this new Bushite governor. But the reason I'm calling is I think there's kind of a stealth attack on the Electoral College. Governor Brown of California recently signed a law which will allocate the 50-some-odd electoral votes of California not to the winner in California, but to the national winner. And I think this is a very bad idea, and let me give an example. Suppose it were a very close election, and everything depended on the votes from Waukesha County in Wisconsin. Let's say, there was a very tight race between Republican and Democrat. And instead of simply deciding the votes of Wisconsin's electoral votes, it would include California's and other states as well. Now, I don't think there's corruption in Waukesha, but I'm sure many Democrats do. The other example would be Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where last year we had voter intimidation by the black nationalists trying to intimidate white voters. And we know now, in testimony before the Civil Rights Commission, that the Attorney General's office under Obama will not defend the rights of white voters or whites when whites are the victims. Like we have the hate crimes, these flash mobs. You don't see Attorney General Holder asking for hate crime stuff against them. And the possibility of an election being stolen by intimidation or corrupt voting in one state, and not just affecting that state, but affecting getting the electoral votes of California and others as well, I think is a very bad idea. It's an attempt to revise the Constitution without doing it legally.
Thanks for the call. Craig.
Well, I'm a little bit familiar with the California action on the Electoral College. My understanding of it is a little bit different, and that is that the way this plan works, I believe, is that California enacted a law that says we'll assign our electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote, but it only takes effect if basically other states adopt the same plan. So in other words, there's a trigger in it. So it wouldn't just happen unilaterally in California. The effect they're trying to achieve is essentially just to make the Electoral College irrelevant and create really a national popular vote. So in other words, if it works the way it's designed, it would just mean that whoever wins the popular vote would get the Electoral College votes, the national popular vote. So it's a little bit different from what the caller was describing, and the only way it would take effect under these statutes is if states totaling an Electoral College majority, enough of those states passed it, and they're not. I think they're some distance there, but some distance away, and I think it's going to be difficult to get that many states to adopt it.
We go to Peter in Black River Falls. Hi.
Good morning, and thanks for the call, and thanks for your guest. Mr. Gilbert, a couple of weeks ago, I believe you wrote about Congressman Paul Ryan and that no one should take his reelection for granted. Would you speak a little bit about what's going on in the 1st Congressional District and the liabilities that Congressman Ryan has taken on with his pretty far-reaching proposal to reshape Medicare?
Well, I mean, I do think he's the odds. I mean, the clear favorite to win re-election. I don't want to exaggerate the his vulnerabilities in his district. I do think it will be a different kind of race, and I do think there's a little bit more of a wild card element just because of the role he's played nationally, his authorship of the Republican budget, and including the plans to overhaul Medicare. A lot of things would have to happen for him to be in trouble in that district. I mean, you know, it would have to be the case that his Medicare plan turns out to be an unambiguous negative for the Republican Party, not just for the Republican Party, but also for him personally. And the way it's played out so far, I think, is that even though it the Democrats believe that his Medicare plan will be a negative for the Republican Party, it may be more of a negative for other Republicans than Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan tends to get credit, at least in the media, for being out front in offering a plan. He is a very effective politician. I mean, he's not the kind of politician that just sort of ignores his own district. So he's a good campaigner. He's an effective politician. What will be different about this race is Wisconsin. The political environment in Wisconsin is quite different, given everything that's happened under Governor Walker and what a crazy political year it's been. You're also going to have the volatility of the presidential election, and then you're going to have this kind of nationalized, quasi-nationalized race in the first district. You could have that if the sense is that he's vulnerable. It could end up attracting a lot of money. And to whatever extent it nationalizes his race, it means that it kind of divides people more along party lines. The other thing I'll mention is that he does have an advantage, built-in advantage in that district, and that that district has become more Republican. It used to be kind of a classic swing district as a result of redistricting, not so much the most recent redistricting plan this year, but the previous one. That made it a little more Republican, and also demographics have made it a little more Republican with the growth of some suburban areas in the district. So he's advantaged by his district as well, which makes it, you know, which also makes it a tough guy to beat.
Thanks, Peter. Jim in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm
sure.
A first-time caller.
Thanks, Jim.
I would like to return, if I could, to the Scott Walker recall issue and ask the question, perhaps I've missed this, who would likely Democratic opponents be against Mr. Governor Walker? And isn't that a very important part of the equation? It's one thing to get a lot of people feeling negative about a particular person, but isn't it something quite different to have all those folks feeling positive about someone
else? That's a good point, right.
Absolutely, and that's one point I was trying to allude to in the piece I wrote over the weekend, which is that, you know, whatever the political climate is, whatever the structure of the electorate is, you know, these elections are choices between candidates, and their strengths and weaknesses have a huge bearing. Just as when you look at the presidential race, no matter how vulnerable President Obama appears to be and whatever the economy is doing, it will matter who his opponent is. It'll be a battle. Democrats will frame it as a choice between Barack Obama and his opponent, just as President Bush in 2004 framed it as a choice between him and John Kerry. So, yes, that goes for the potential recall against Governor Walker. Who's his opponent going to be? That's a huge question. The name that traditionally has gotten the most discussion among Democrats is Russ Feingold, but you know, we don't know if Russ Feingold wants to do this. I mean, he's a hard guy to read, and you know, one of these days we'll find out.
Who do you think would be strong, Jim?
Well, I don't know if I have a particular view on that, but if you allow me one sort of divergence from that question, would it be advisable for a candidate to emerge before the recall, or as a matter of strategy, would it be better after the recall? I tend to think perhaps after the recall, but...
Well, that's a good question, because I think you can argue either way. I mean, you could argue that it might be smart to wait and let, you know, kind of let this sort of process unfold so that people are making a statement about their desire to recall the governor and it's not framed as a choice yet at that point. But you could also argue that, especially in the wake of these recalls that just happened, it may be helpful for Democrats to have somebody to rally around as the process unfolds in order to give it energy and momentum. So, again, this is one more kind of tactical question and consideration for Democrats as they kind of go off into the unknown. It would be the third. There have only been two recalls, successful recalls of governors in our history, and one was about 90 years ago in Idaho, and the other one was, of course, the recall of Gray Davis in California, which led to the election of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for calling. I feel like we're always off into the unknown these days, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, who knows? Any predictions for tomorrow?
No, I don't make predictions. I think the one race it's only the one race that's really in doubt, which is the Holborn race.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's significant. The outcome is significant. I think if 17, 16, 18, 15, it's significant in terms of legislation, and it's significant psychologically.
Right. Thank you, Craig, as always.
It's a pleasure.
Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our All Things Political guest this hour, as he is frequently. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour of Monday Conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.